Hey, we're really excited to welcome Caleb Merrill to the podcast. He is the OG of Avalanche podcasts. If you haven't heard him on the Avalanche Hour podcast, you really need to check it out. Caleb's got a unique position in the Avalanche industry. He works as a mountain guide, Avalanche forecaster, and Avalanche educator. He's up in Eastern Oregon, and he's also talked to pretty much everyone in the industry on his podcast. So he's been exposed to all kinds of different perspectives and ideas. And he's kind of like this unique position to spread out all those ideas to the rest of the Avalanche world. So welcome, Caleb. Good to have you here.
Jeff, Dave, thanks for having me. Yeah, happy to be here.
Yeah, dude. I'm feeling leveled up right now. This is episode one of season two, and we got the OG, like the biggest podcaster in this space right here.
Well, you guys okay. Are talking it up quite a bit here, but you know, the Avalanche Hour podcast has been a super fun project of mine, kind of a side gig, and you know, it kind of came about in 2016. I was driving to ISSW in Breckenridge with some friends, and we were like, oh, let's get our brains tuned up for this ISSW. Like, there must be some podcasts about avalanches. So you put in a simple podcast search for avalanches, and all that came up was the Colorado Avalanche hockey team podcast, right? Which I'm sure has a pretty strong following.
It does around here.
Yeah, and then in just talking with some people at ISSW that year, you know, it seemed like it would be a cool project to take on, and you know, Doug Krause started his podcast Slide. That was, you know, I think he did two seasons of that, and that was like so good. I wish he would bring it back, yeah. Or at least I should get him on my podcast at some point. But yeah, and it's cool to see kind of this space grow, and you know, I think that the biggest way that I learn is from storytelling, from hearing other people's stories, and I can remember back to being a rookie ski patroller and just hanging out in the locker room after, you know, maybe a week of avalanche mitigation, just going hard up on the ridge, and just hearing stories of veteran ski patrollers telling, you know, their lessons learned over the years. And it was just so impactful to me for my career. And many of those stories are still with me today, and I think about them all the time in the winter. So trying to expand that out through the podcast has been a super fun venture. And just getting to connect with so many people within our community, both in the States and in Canada and over in Europe as well. So yeah, it's fun, and it's a shared endeavor. I have some guest hosts, and so that's kind of where I'm hoping to lead the podcast these days, is to get different perspectives and different voices, a more diverse array of folks that are asking the questions of some of the leaders within our industry. So it's cool to, I've really enjoyed tuning into some of the All Aspects Savvy podcasts as well. I think you guys are doing a great job.
That's high praise coming for you, man. Thank you for that. Your pod is awesome. I gotta be totally honest here. I actually didn't know it existed until you did it with Jeff. And then I went and listened to like six episodes.
And it was like, nice.
Sweet. But yeah, Jeff, let's jump into some. Okay. I know you had some burning questions.
I've got one for Caleb right off the bat. So I noticed on your podcast, you're real good about creating a welcoming place where people can open up and talk about the closest they've come to death with an avalanche on your podcast. And that you kind of hold that space, so it's not judgy. It's like, no, we've all made mistakes as professionals. And I think it's really helpful to normalize that, so that instead of a culture of shame and blame, it's like, no, here's what everyone can learn from this. So what I want to know is, after all these stories you've heard, and then different perspectives, it's like that analogy of like the blind guy groping the elephant, a whole bunch of folks who are like describing different parts of the elephant. So you heard the elephant described from so many different perspectives. How has that changed how you manage risk in avalanche terrain? You know, were there some perspectives that really resonated with you and you're like, ooh, that's changed the way I go about my teaching, my forecasting, my guiding?
Yeah, I mean, I think there have been some trends lately where more experienced users are getting caught, right? Like we're watching the demographic, and this is kind of anecdata, but you know, we're watching the demographic get a little bit older, a little bit more experienced. And so I think it kind of comes down to, I would sum that up simply with Andre Roche's quote of, the Avalanche does not know that you're an expert, or the Avalanche doesn't care what you know, you know? And so like, I think when, how it's affected, how listening to so many stories of near misses and close calls and accidents has affected me is just building wider margins into my day, you know, and and understanding that I'm not, even though I live and breathe this stuff, you know, I still have weaknesses. I also have strengths, but I am not immune to the fallacies of the human condition, you know, and I know, I understand that when I'm standing at the top of a slope, if I don't have a well thought out plan for the day and I find myself somewhere that looks really enticing, I'm really going to want to ski it. Like the addiction can be real, right? And I think it's like real to talk about it as an addiction, and being aware of like our fallacies of falling into those traps. So I think wider margins, you know, I'm really impacted by people celebrating turning around and being okay with that. And kind of, I've tried to bring that into my practice, into my guiding, and recreational riding out there. So, I think another theme that comes up a lot is just having a repeatable process, especially in kind of the recreational user patch, you know, like having a process that creating good habits in the backcountry takes work, and it's not something that is just given to you by taking a rec level one course. It takes practice and application and some discipline. So, you know, I think back to when I started getting into recreational backcountry skiing. I was like concurrently a ski patroller and, you know, running avalanche mitigation routes, and kind of created this somewhat of a false sense of security, or maybe not security, but false sense of comfortability with triggering avalanches, right? In a semi-controlled environment of the ski area. And then I started getting into more ski touring, and I was like, wow, this is a totally different game, you know, venturing into a natural snowpack that's not mitigated. And maybe at this point, we're not dealing with just surface instabilities that we're trying to mitigate at the ski area, you know, aside from early season opening of terrain when you might be dealing with a deeper persistent weak layer or something. But, you know, that application of moving into a different context, I think, is sometimes understated. And I know it was for my career, you know, like my ventures into the backcountry. It was kind of like, you know, there's a ability to misapply context of what you're doing based on your experiences in a different context, if that makes sense.
I do that all the time. I'm like, brand new sport. This is probably the same as skiing. Like, I'm pretty good at skiing. I'll probably be pretty good at this sport. And then it's like 15 minutes into it, I'm like, oh no, this is a completely different thing, Dave. Go back to level zero.
Like, right, totally. Yeah, I think, you know, I'm reminded of something that one of my mentors, Fred Aldridge, said. I heli-ski guided with him in the Rubies and fought some fire with him as well. And when I interviewed him for the podcast, he talked about how the novice focuses on the basics and the masters focus on the basics, right? And that kind of, in my mind, that kind of leads into kind of the Dunning-Kruger effect, right? And like, where is our level of confidence with our skills and our abilities and our knowledge and our uncertainties in the backcountry realm? And trying to honestly assess that in yourself, I think, is a really essential skill into keeping yourself safe. Like, what do I know? What do I not know? And what do I not know that I don't know? If that makes sense.
It's the unknown unknowns.
The Donald Rumsfeld, a Zen cone square, the unknown unknowns. Yeah.
Yeah. Because they're all like there. That.
the Mark Twain quote of, it ain't the things you don't know that get you. It's the things you know for sure that just ain't so. I was like, oh, interesting. That's the human factor trap. Yeah. Well, hey, yeah. So we're the gist of our podcast is to talk about how we do dangerous things the safest way possible. And how has that changed over time for you? Because that's what you do in all the hats you wear, whether it's guiding, forecasting, or teaching. You're helping people do risky things the safest way possible. How's your thinking and your approach changed over time?
Well, plus, Jeff, he's also like, I mean, I watched you on the, I don't know, it was like that sled podcast from 2023.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And you had some really good insight about the transition between, or taking your skills from what you know about in the backcountry and then like applying them into this, I mean, essentially a brand new sport. And, you know, like, even though, yeah, like snow, you're well-versed and know how to think about and how to approach avalanche problems. It was like a whole new thing when you got on the sled finally.
Yeah, it's totally different application. It's really cool to like be back at the beginner stage. You know, I'm probably like a blue square sledder at this point, but like feeling the progression there and taking that application and putting it into just a whole different mode of travel, but in a familiar backcountry setting has been, I think, I don't think I even expected it to be as different as it has been, but there's been a lot of learning and growth, and I certainly make, I think I make more conservative decisions on my sled just because of my ability to maneuver the machine. Then, you know, I feel quite a bit more nimble on my skis. But kind of going back to Jeff's original question, like I look back to starting my podcast, and I don't think I knew this at the time, but I think subconsciously, like, I was looking for the magic bullet that doesn't exist. And I had always been told that it didn't exist, right? But I saw all of these people out there seemingly doing it, like seemingly, and this is where social media, like, don't even get me started on social media and the facade that it creates of what people are doing in the backcountry. It's ridiculous. And I think it's super detrimental in some ways to our community. But, you know, I think subconsciously I was looking for this magic bullet, and I'm like, oh, well, I'm going to talk to people like Jeff Banks. Like, he's been doing this for a super long time. Like, he's got to have like the secret sauce, like the magic to it. And just to answer your same question, you know, like, how are we going to do these risky things in the safest way possible? And what I found out is there's no magic bullet, and it takes a lot of patience, and it takes saying no. It takes looking at yourself introspectively and identifying your strengths and weaknesses. And I think you're probably reaching for kind of like tangible things that I do to manage my risk. And that's all stuff that has been super vetted and is embedded in our avalanche education, you know, curriculums throughout the state, you know, like the repeatable process, like dialing in your tour planning, previewing the terrain before you enter the terrain, having options in your day so that, you know, I like to say, like, the only certain thing out there is uncertainty. Like, you're going to run into areas of uncertainty anytime you go into the backcountry. And so to have options within your day to retreat to safer terrain is super essential, and to expect the unexpected. So those are some ways that, like, I feel like I've tried to implement some of these tools into my own recreational skiing or riding. And I, you know, it's sometimes it's easier to apply those things in a more operational setting because that's a little bit more embedded in the culture, you know, especially with AMGA guide training and, you know, operating off a run list, making our decisions about what we're going to ski when we're in a warm yurt or in a coffee shop and not making those decisions in the field, is,
can
I think,
interrupt one for a second?
Totally.
I think what you're saying there for our audience is super important. I think a lot of folks think a mountain guide goes out and puts their finger to the air and says, oh, we're going to ski this. Let me dig a couple pits along the way and we'll make that decision. And it's like, no, 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 no. It's been gathering data throughout the whole season. And then the run list is made at home. And we can't green light terrain in the field. We can only red light terrain and fall back to more conservative options when we're confronted with more uncertainty in the field. And the observations we're gathering, they're not to ski steeper stuff. It's not like, oh, we'll get up there and dig a pit and ski the bowl if it looks good. It's like, no, no, no. We're checking to confirm our hypothesis. And if it's more uncertain than we thought, that's where those options to fall back are super clutch. I think that's super important, and maybe something that people don't quite understand about the avalanche industry. If you're a layperson just out skiing, and I think a lot of folks will say, well, let's go to this zone and we'll figure it out. And I'm like, whoa, hold on, I don't think I want to go for that trip.
Yeah. And you know, and I'm guilty of that at times. You know, what I've tried to turn that into is like, okay, well, let's ratchet back my goals or objectives for the day. If my uncertainty lies in the terrain and I haven't been able to get a good handle on the terrain through mapping software, guidebooks, talking to people, getting beta, then, you know, like I know that my uncertainty may lie within the snowpack and the terrain, and I'm going to dial back and kind of turn that day into more of a recon tour, right? Like, maybe I do need to be in the field and see the terrain to really like understand some of the nuances of certain terrain traps or convex features or unsupported slopes. But I'm going to frame my day as I'm just going to go stick to ridgelines and terrain less than 30 degrees and get a handle, become more familiar with this terrain before I maybe engage in more consequential aspects of that terrain. And that takes patience, you know, and I understand that's difficult if you just have maybe one or two days a week to get in the backcountry and there's this like pressure that maybe people put on themselves or they feel from social media to perform. And I think that stress can become real and people are resistant to throw away a day, so to speak, air quotes there, throw away a day doing the recon and really doing the research that they need to intimately know the terrain that they're going to be recreating in or operating in.
Yeah, I think of that idea of, you know, going out and getting skunked. And when I was younger, that used to happen where you're like, oh, we've got this idealized plan. And then we're like, oh, conditions are super sketch and there's no backup plan. And now, you know, particularly last year, I think we talked about how all over the Mountain West, there was a freakishly high number of high danger days. And we were just pegged at considerable with a persistent weak layer for much of the winter. So it's like, okay, doing more effort on tour planning. You know, every time I go out now, we're having a rewarding tour, even if it means exactly what you said, staying on ridgelines and keeping it under 30 degrees. And it's like zero stress, super fun. And we're getting whumps, collapses, remote triggers, but we're in this island in the sky where the only dangerous terrain is below us. And there's almost like this smug satisfaction of feeling like, man, conditions are really tricky, but by choosing gentle terrain, we're having so much fun and I'm not puckered, I'm not gripped, and I'm not losing sleep the night before because we've already done our tour plan and we know we're set up to have a great tour no matter what.
Yeah, and you feel better at the end of the day, like you nailed it. Like, not that you got away with something that you're like, ooh, like, well, I think we nailed it, but I'm not sure, you know? Yeah, I like that feeling a lot better than the feeling of kind of guilt of like, ooh, I think I got away with something.
Yeah.
Well, and also, also just adjusting to be like, you can set expectations for any activity you go do, right? Whether it's skiing or climbing or biking or whatever. But if like you ratchet it back to just being specifically with skiing of like, hey, we're going out skiing today. And like for the sake of going out skiing today, then like you open yourself up to having a great time, kind of whatever happens, you know, like it takes that pressure way back. It's only when you start being like, we're going to go to this zone, hit these lines. Like that's when things start getting really muddy and gray on like the risk factor, at least from what I've experienced.
Yeah, I totally agree, Dave. I think like kind of leaving the expectations of the day at home is, and just fostering a cautious curiosity about what's going on, and enjoying the time that you have out there with those people, you know, that's the best way to approach it, in my opinion.
Yeah. It's like, well, you could be sitting at your desk, or right, you could be out on skis.
Yeah. You know, Caleb, one thing that resonated when you said, hey, you know, I was hoping to find the magic bullet and to talk to all these experts who have spent 10, 20, 30, 40 years in the industry, surely I'm going to stumble into the magic bullet. And the closest bullet that I found is the big buffers to ward off the uncertainty. And with having large buffers, I'm like, hey, everything we do, driving a car, getting out of bed in the morning, has residual risk. And it's always going to be there. However, if I can make sure those safety buffers are quite robust between me and the anticipated problems, that can allow for the wild cards to come up in the deck, Joker to rear its head and be like, oh, we've got a big enough buffer, it's not going to catch us, or it's unlikely to catch us. And it's brought the stress down so much that even though I'm not riding super steep lines like I used to, that satisfaction of being like, I'm not scared and I'm not going to inadvertently get my clients or friends killed, that satisfaction goes way up. And the whole experience becomes very different and really deeply satisfying of, okay, I've recalibrated, I think, and we're doing this in a sustainable manner that's really stress-free. And then when we do get those days where stability lines up, you're like, okay, these are the days to go steeper. And it's okay if there's less on the year of that. It's setting us up for success, and we're just not scared.
Yeah. Yeah, Jeff, like, what do you think of as your areas of uncertainty when you head out on a ski tour?
Oh, man.
His cameraman. Right,
you're dropping back into podcast host role here.
No, that's right. Well,
he's like, where's Dave?
From skiing a little bit around this area, it's unusual for us not to have a persistent weak layer of concern. It's very unusual. Occasionally, after, you know, we've been getting these massive 10 inches of swee, that's snow water equivalent for the non-avalanche geeks out there. So that's 10 inches of water weight. And then, you know, sometimes after that, when the snowpack has a chance to either avalanche off or kind of consolidate into a 2-meter snowpack, then we might get a window of low danger. And we're like, oh, wow, this is incredibly rare mid-season. But for the most of the time we're out there, there is an area of concern. And if you want to get away from that faceted layer or surface tour layer, it means you got to go on the sunny side. And Colorado is so far south that we'll often have sun crust. Even if the sun's out for 10 minutes, you get a zipper crust. So you're often skiing the shady side where the PWL is. And so just giving big buffers on that. And after going through the data and being like, oh, okay, here's the rules. And, you know, we didn't do this on on your show, but, you know, basically the generalized, simple, write it down on an envelope or put it down on your skis with a marker. You know, the algorithm rules are really conservative that we're using for Aspect Abbey. So if it's low danger, keep it under 40. If it's moderate danger, keep it under 35. So that's still black diamond terrain. And if it's scary moderate, which is what the pros always call moderate with a PWL, and the public may not have heard of that term before, but we use it. We're like, hey, different rules, because that PWL kills about 95% of the victims in Colorado. So it's the best predictor of danger. So if it's scary moderate, then it's keep it under 33 degrees and stay out of the runout zones. And I love being able to measure the runout zones now. That's really something that makes me warm and fuzzy inside instead of guessing. I hate guessing. And then if it's considerable danger, keeping it under 30 and out of the runout zones.
Yeah.
Those are just real simple rules to live by for a long, happy life in the backcountry. And, you know, people ask me, oh, but you must do it differently on your day off. I'm like, no, I still don't want to die on my day off. And I like to be really relaxed and stress-free. And, you know, there are times where if you know those rules really well, there's four exceptions where you can push it. But for me, that just makes life super simple and fun and gives us wide buffers. And it's not to say that that's no risk, but it's really low risk. And it's more in line with my risk tolerance now. And also just being around doing this for three decades, I've seen a lot of surprises where I was absolutely certain. And then it turns out I was dead wrong and almost really dead. And so that's given me such a healthy respect of just like, put those buffers up, keep the car on the road with those guardrails, and life's really fun.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, no doubt.
I want to kind of ask you a little like a broader question. Jeff, thank you for taking us on our detour through the Aspect Abbey podcast or the Aspect Abbey app as usual.
The shameless product plug.
Yeah. But I wanted to, I know Jeff talks about this a lot, and we've talked about this with people like Angela Haas and stuff like that. But over, I mean, you've been in this for what, two decades, like 20 years, something
almost,
like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, you know, you're starting on ski patrol at Solitude. I think I saw, you know, you've been guiding, you've been doing all this stuff. Like, has there been like a general shift in the way people view risk that you've seen over that time period? And then have there been maybe like sort of bigger moments where like the whole thing kind of shifted that you can think of? I'm just curious to see what your thoughts on that are.
Yeah, it's a good question, Dave. I think, you know, risk tolerance is such a personal thing to many people. And like you can break it down to some kind of sciencey or heady terms, but I think in general, we have seen a shift, and I think that people are starting to step it back, but they're not showcasing that. And I hope I'm not stepping around your question too much, but like what really gets me jazzed up is seeing Instagram posts or videos of professional skiers being really honest about their process of engaging in consequential terrain and getting a behind the scenes look into what goes into that and how often people are turning around and celebrating that. And so I think as a whole, our culture is starting to embrace that. But it's, I mean, let's be real. It's not as sexy as nailing the line, you know, like that does not get the clicks, you know, I don't know that I can like pinpoint one event or even a series of events that's happened there. I think generally just kind of the outreach and education movement that's happened and the amount of resources that the community is putting into education collectively is helping to create a shift, especially in the recreationist side of backcountry riding. But, you know, I think for me personally, kind of like just dropping the ego a little bit, trying to approach entering the backcountry with humility and a humble attitude has served me really well. And it's not something that I claim to have perfected yet, but it's something that I work on every time that I go out there and allow me the ability, it allows me the ability to be surprised through proper terrain margins and proper planning and yeah, I guess just kind of understanding that I'm not always going to have understanding and accepting that I might not always have the whole picture helps to ratchet it back for me. I don't know if that answered your question, Dave.
Totally. I just find it fascinating. People, you know, like my background is slopestyle and half pipe skiing. And, you know, mm-hmm. when we would go in the backcountry, it was like building booters. And we had zero self-awareness of what we were doing, you know, like just building jumps wherever there was a sweet steep landing kind of thing, not really being very aware of the broader terrain we were in. And so for me now, like hanging out with Jeff and talking to all these people who are undeniably the like the OGs of this industry, like it's like what anyone kind of like I've just started realizing how much I didn't know, you know. And I just find it really interesting hearing from people who've been in it for a long time about kind of just the way it's changed over the years. You know, we were talking to Angela about like client expectations. You know, 20 years ago, people like wanted that crazy adrenaline experience. And she's like, now people are like, yeah, we want to go to this beautiful place and do this big thing that we're proud of. But, you know, like we all want to make it back to the boat, you know, kind of thing. So I think your answer was great. There wasn't a wrong right or a wrong answer to that.
It makes me think a little bit about like and reflect on some of my guiding, more specifically heli-ski guiding, of my perception of my guests' expectations, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
totally. I will go into a day thinking that these people want to ski super steep lines, gnarly terrain, and then come to find out they're just like totally happy just being out in the middle of the Chugach with nobody around and just being in this beautiful place, like skiing appropriately matched terrain for the conditions, you know? And it's gotten me in trouble before, or came very close to getting me in trouble, of like mismatching my perception of other people's expectations. So that's a red flag for me when I start projecting what I think other people are expecting.
Man, that seems like something that would be hashed out. Like how, you know, is that just like the vibe you're getting when you're talking to people, or what leads to that?
Oh, I mean, yeah, it is the vibe that I'm getting when I first meet them. It's just watching them on their first run, kind of watching their body language when they're talking to their buddies. If I think that I'm serving up something that's pretty mellow, you know, and that's a terrain progression is a great tool for getting to know your clients and getting to know what's going on in the snow, and kind of starting with some slope of low or no consequence and getting more questions to your answers or answers to your questions, and then moving into maybe some steeper terrain if things are lining up. But it brings about like this approach to guiding that is just more honest and open, and I'm you know, I get a little bit vulnerable and I ask the people what they want to do. You know, we're somewhat of a team out there, even in a guiding scenario. And that's how I approach guiding is I if I'm out there with four people, 4-to-1 guiding, that's like, I'm not very good at math, but I think it's 10 eyes out there instead of just my 2 eyes. Right. And I try and utilize my guests to let me know how they're feeling and also what they're seeing out there, because sometimes I miss things. It's hard to imagine, but I'm sure you can relate.
Well, that's unique compared to, you know, I've heard Jeff's experience with tour planning and stuff for clients, but I think Jeff, you're much more on the touring kind of side where it's, you know, a bit more of like, we're going to go to a zone for the day. But with heli, you have so many more runs and so much more accessibility like that. I didn't really think about that until just now.
Yeah, I would echo Caleb's reflection of that self-imposed pressure of I'm supposed to know exactly where the line is and take the guests right up to the line. That's how I felt at the early part of my career. And then it was like, this is ridiculous. Like, you know, nobody knows exactly where the line is, so we need to give a buffer. And I really like a collaborative approach of, hey, team, here's where I think we're going to have good and reasonably safe riding today. What is your preference? And then find out. And when you were just talking about how you gauge the clients, it's always tricky because some of them may not have skied that year or in a couple years, and this is their big trip. And, you know, their memory of what they used to be able to do doesn't match up with reality. And then all of a sudden they've got a pack on and it's really deep powder. It's really tricky to gauge on your first day with a client, or particularly the first run. And you want to ease into it and then have a lot of different options so you can pivot quickly within your safety guardrails of, okay, this is where we're going to find reasonably good snow and reasonably safe snow that's appropriate for the clients and what's going to give them good expectations. But I really like an inclusive process where they're giving me feedback, try to get as much information as you can before, and then also setting the expectations of, hey, it's considerable with the PWL. We are not going into avalanche terrain today. I just want to get that out front. That's just how it is right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I love kind of like the overcautious approach to setting those expectations. Right. And I think you're spot on. Anytime there's a persistent weak layer, it's like, okay, heads up, you guys, we got uncertainty in the snowpack and some potentially touchy conditions. Like, yeah, set the bar low for their expectations. And then, you know, I almost always find that we exceed those expectations and people end up having a great day. So, yeah.
Well, people are always going to like pound their chest and talk a big game, but like, it's like so impossible if you've just like ripped a whole face, even if it's not like the scariest cool R ever. Like if it's like a chill, wide open snowfield, but everyone just got to do like unlimited turns, like you would have to be the most depressed person on earth to not have a great time doing that. Like,
yeah, don't tell me that's not fun.
Yeah, come on, man. Like the reality is if we got dropped off on top of stuff that you see in like TGR or Matchstick or something, like all of us, myself included, would shit their pants. Like,
yeah.
We'd be like, no, heli back, we're out of here.
Yeah.
Yeah. For sure. You know, to pile on that, if you look at the stats from Switzerland, I think they've got something like 86% of avalanches for the fatalities are 35 degrees and over. And you can have a lot of fun skiing a black diamond slope that's 30, 32, 33. And skiing powder on a black diamond slope is a lot of fun and have a lot less stress. Like if that was like one rule to live by, that's a pretty good one of, hey, if you've got uncertainty, man, if you keep it under 35, you've screened out a lot of your risk and you know, you can still have really good black diamond terrain or, you know, and then if you start being like, oh, well, you know, if we got a PWL and it's considerable, hey, let's do a steep blue run today, skiing powder and beautiful setting with your friends. You're like, man, that was a great day.
Yeah. I think that's where kind of like Aspect Avi is a great tool for people to utilize to kind of bring about appropriate ski tours for the given conditions for that day, you know? And I'll be upfront, like I'm pretty skeptical of new technology that claims to keep us safe in the backcountry because ultimately it's up to us, right? And I think tools like Aspect Avi help us stay in the guardrails within the guardrails. Tools like utilizing a run list, even in a recreational setting, help us do that as well. But, you know, ultimately every accident is a series of decisions and you kind of have to be able to step back and gain bigger perspective throughout your day of how many holes in the Swiss cheese are lining up. Right. And
yeah.
I kind of have like a rule of three, you know, like if, and it could be super outside factors, like background things in my life that are just limiting my ability to stay in the present moment, you know, just kind of background noise in your life that might not be on your A game. So like if I forget an essential item for my pack, that's kind of like a check. That's like one strike for me. And that kind of sets the tone for the day. And then if I'm, you know, having trouble communicating with my partners, like we're just not seeming to be on the same page, even like time trusted partners, you know, sometimes it's just like the sauce isn't there for the day. And that might be another, you know, strike, and then getting a bunch of red flags out there, cracking, collapsing, recent loading from wind or snow, you know, that might be another one. And kind of like trying to keep track of those strikes against the day, and then being really honest with that and taking a step back in my terrain choices, given maybe those three strikes. I'd like to come up with a list of kind of like these watch out situations. I think it's termed personal disaster flags by some others, but yeah.
PDFs.
I hadn't heard that. That's great. Did reflect back on you. You started with, you're like, hey, if there's three strikes, I'm going to scale way back. That started with self-assessment and then team assessment. And the very last thing you talked about was snow assessment. That's fascinating.
Right. Yeah.
That's a very mental approach. I mean,
we're all humans, and you look at any of these accidents and there's like numerous human factors involved, right? And ultimately that's the hardest thing to control is ourselves, but it's the thing that we have the most control over.
Yeah, it's pretty rare that it's a low danger day and we're doing everything reasonably conservative and we get smoked, right? It's like, what's the famous stat? It's like 90% of avalanche fatalities can be attributed to human factors, where we knew it was dangerous and we somehow justified going in there. And, you know, McCammon's classic facets is a great acronym for helping people remember that, where you've got familiarity, acceptance, commitment, expert halo, and then you've got I think tracks. Like social proof, and then the last one, scarcity, or you could flip those last two letters. You know, those are the classic Danny Kahneman, Amos Tversky human factor traps applied in an avalanche context and repurposed. And the really tricky part, and I think this will be the next area, I mean, this is all behavioral economics theory, is how to pre-diagnose and treat that. Because we're really good at identifying the causes of the disease, but not so much at treating it right now. It's pretty tough. I don't know. You got any things that you've used to help kind of treat those, whether it's in the field or before you leave the house in your planning process?
One thing that I've come across lately is kind of like communication styles with your partners. And this is a bit of a broader topic that we could riff on in terms of like choosing your partners wisely. And, you know, some of my best friends, like I can't ski with them because we just either we egg each other on too much or we just have different communication styles. And so I think like it's really important to pick your partners wisely and really be honest about like if you're a good match or not. And there's uncertainty in your group. And if you have that uncertainty, then that's another flag to kind of listen to scale back your terrain selection. I've seen this trend of just kind of like a lot of social skiing where these groups get really big and communication just becomes really hindered within a group of, you know, more than three or four people. And it can be really hard to make consequential decisions. But I got a little off topic there. I think one tool that I've been trying to implement is like discussing with my partners, will, want, and won't. So like, I want to do this, I will do this, or I won't do this. And just being really honest in your tour planning phase before you even hit the skin track of like, nope, this is off the table. And that's essentially a run list, but then kind of checking back in and kind of like will, want, won't. Like, how are you feeling about this? No, Dave's like, no, I won't ski this. No. And we all need to respect that. And Jeff, you might be like, well, I will ski this, but Caleb's like, I want to ski this, and kind of questioning our motivations around that, I think can be really good reflection on the decisions that you're about to make, and taking, giving that the time, right? Like building time. We talk about terrain margins all the time, but like, what about time margins? You know, like we cram so much shit into our lives these days that like the last thing that we want to do is take, you know, 45 minutes to plan a tour at the beginning of the day. All of a sudden we're at like 1 o'clock or something. Nothing good happens after 10 in the mountains, right? Like you kind of like build in these time buffers. Or if you're out with Jeff, I've heard that you know, like definitely pack some extra batteries for your headlamp.
Yeah,
might be coming back late.
So many times Jeff's like, it's going to be 2 hours. And like 5 hours later, we're like on our second peak. You can't, he's undeniably stoked. He's good at talking you into stuff because he's pumped. But then you're like,
yeah,
I didn't bring food for this.
It's good that it's consistent so that all my friends know, hey, right, Jeff, we're going to have to check you here with your enthusiasm because, you know, your concept of time is more in sync with maybe like Polynesian concept of like space and time. Apparently, like some Polynesian cultures, the greeting isn't, hey, how's it going? It's where have you come from? It's very directional oriented, and it's a navigation culture. And that really resonates with me. But like, I don't even own a watch. Like, that's kind of a telltale sign right there.
Yeah, but Jeff, you have one on your phone, dude. Come on, don't even be on that high horse. Like, true. Caleb, wait, I want to jump into something a little more macro, because I think you have another cool insights on this probably. You know, obviously, you kind of perfectly segued us, actually. You know, Jeff and I have an opinion about where this industry is headed as far as managing, you know, risk in the backcountry and that kind of stuff. Like, where are there trends that you've been seeing growing in like the forecasting world, like that you think are going to catch on, or maybe things that are on the horizon? I feel like you've probably been privy to some cool conversations in this arena that maybe you could offer us a little insight on.
Like, where's the industry headed for?
Yeah. Like, how are we going to be forecasting in 5 years? Like, what's this look like? What's this whole thing? What's this all about?
I think one of the super pivotal moments was the release of the conceptual model of avalanche hazard from Grant Statham and others that kind of creates a roadmap to communicating hazard to the public, right, or within operations. So identifying what the problem is, where the problem is, the likelihood, sensitivity, all leading into, okay, this is going to create where our hazard level is for the day. So much more of a roadmap than what it, I mean, not that it wasn't informed before, but everybody is kind of trying to read off the same sheet of music, no matter where you're at. And so a little bit more of a formulaic, approach to avalanche forecasting. I think one thing that's pretty interesting, and I'm hoping to get Pascal Hagley on my podcast to talk about is forecaster uncertainty, and how does the public react to a forecast that I put out where I say I have really low certainty in my forecast, because sometimes that's the case. And in the past, you know, we kind of try to write that in a forecast discussion, like, look, this persistent weak layer is pretty sporadic out here. This is where we think it is, but, you know, we don't have that much data on it, and we need more. And so our uncertainty is pretty high for this forecast, and how the public will react to that. You know, pulling the veil back a bit, you know, of like, yeah, we don't know everything, and we're not going to know everything. And it all comes back to, like, there's only one way to use that uncertainty, and that's to buffer your terrain, bigger margins.
I wonder if, you know, can I just like add on to that really quick? Something like you talk about, you know, like being a forecaster, it's super hard. Like, you have a huge zone that you're basically like taking the temperature of, and like you can't know what every face is like, what every aspect's like. Like, there's no, physically no way for that to happen. And something I've thought about a bit, like kind of moving into the future, you know, like the new iPhones, you can text via satellite, you know, like all this kind of stuff. I wonder if we'll start seeing a bit of a more decentralized approach, you know, where the forecast is there, and then throughout the day, you're getting these like actual live updates with geo data, like where people are, being sent in like as it's happening, because they don't have to wait to report it maybe when they get back to the parking lot or whatever. And, you know, like maybe over time having, you know, like having data from years of people reporting things on their phone, you know, like that'll give you guys a better idea of like, oh, you know, like this area tends to be a little trickier. This area tends to be pretty reliable, you know? And like, I'm curious to see if you think, you know, like maybe that will play into how the forecast looks in the future and like helping people navigate.
Yeah, I think it will. And I think it has, you know, I think just there's been an increase in public observations at all avalanche centers, you know, in the last 5 to 10 years. Like, people are starting to understand that they can help inform the forecast. And especially, you know, like where I avalanche forecast, we have four different zones, and you know, two of them have semi-popular, you know, backcountry skiing areas, and two of them are more snow machine based. But we operate in like a super data sparse environment for our forecast center, and so we totally rely on these public observations. And I agree that like in the future, if there's more direct ways for that to happen real time, and I like how you guys have incorporated that into Aspect Abbey for your own, you know, like for me personally to be able to track the red flags that I'm seeing on my ski tour on Aspect Abbey is super helpful. And then that kind of like trims some of the available terrain based on those red flags. And in the same way, I think, and people are doing it on social media, you know, tagging Utah Avalanche Center or whatever when they're out there and they're videoing wind loading that's happening or cracking or collapsing, stuff like that. So I think the bigger centers that have a bit more of a population base, I think that's ongoing and super helpful to inform the forecast. Yeah. I think another area that is maybe we're gonna see a lot of advent is both flexible forecast zones, which Colorado is using now, and Avalanche Canada. And so instead of trying to like conform to for our avalanche problems to fit into a certain box, we're kind of like it doesn't depend on geographic lines necessarily. Of course, certain loading patterns and stuff do have very much terrain influence, but you know, the idea of flexible zones, I think, is going to catch on. And then more modeling, you know, like I have been resistant to AI and kind of like, I think that the computers are going to win eventually, beat us.
it would seem that way.
But, you know, like the
can keep us alive.
Right.
But just Skynet. Kind of like, you're
totally. We're gonna see advents in that with snowpack modeling and some AI influence, I think, into our avalanche forecasts in the future. I'm not sure what it looks like because, again, I kind of resist it. But
yeah, Dave, to riff off your question, you know, I think a real simple way is, my God, the push notifications, like everything, I turn them off on my phone. I'm like, I just want to know if somebody's calling me. That's it. Don't intrude on my mental space. However, I would be more than happy to get a push notification from my local Abbey Center or from Aspect Abbey that said, hey, somebody just had a skier triggered avalanche. Here's the elevation aspect, maybe even a photo. And here's the observer. And we're bumping up the forecast. Yep. To considerable. It's not moderate. You know, new shit has come to light, to quote the Big Lebowski. You know, that kind of happened two seasons ago in Crested Butte in real time. It was the first warm up of the year in April. And there's an indicator slope right across from the school in town. And it went D3 to the ground. And it was like, oh, you know, wet slabs are notoriously difficult to get the timing right on. And it happened 2 days before the forecast center thought it was going to go. And they updated the forecast in real time. But unless you saw that avalanche and thought, oh, let's go see what the Abbey Center is saying, you know, you weren't getting a push notification. And I think that could be a really interesting way to harness technology in a very beneficial way where, you know, a lot of us are touring outside of cell range, but that cell range is getting, cell coverage is getting better and better every year. And if you bump up above tree line, we often have enough to get a text. And then like what you were saying, Dave, with the new satellite capabilities coming with the iPhone new generations, or if you're hooked up through your Garmin inReach, you can get it no matter what.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that something that's on the radar for Aspect Abbey? Like I know that you can identify red flags while you're in the field, and that's just like kind of influences the shading on my phone. But like, what if I'm out there and you guys are out there and I notice a red flag. Is that something that's coming down the line for Aspect Abbey? Like you could get a push notification that I'm seeing signs of instability?
Yeah, yeah. Jeff, is it?
It is. Yeah, it is. I can't give you a date of when it's going to come in. It's all dependent on investment and how many dev team members we can, you know, chain to their desks and crank away on code. But we've gotten that idea from a lot of folks, like Waze or Google Maps asks for your input to update. Is there a speed trap here? Is there an accident here? Is that car moved off the side of the road that was blocking lane of traffic? And the same idea. And the, you know, I love that the community is so engaged with this because so much of this stuff is like, you know, I've got some ideas of what I think should be in the ideal app. But when you get information from hundreds of people at this point and input and catalog all that on a digital sticky note board, you're like, oh my God, the ideas here are endless. And so, you know, real simple, here's a couple ideas. Let's say you're Bluetoothing through your Garmin inReach so you can send a text no matter where. You could send your observation. Hey, we just skier triggered a D2. Here's the aspect elevation. Here's a photo. You know, here's the run out, blah, blah, blah. All the pertinent information that goes to the Abbey Center immediately. So then they can update anything they need on their end. And then if you allow push notifications, you could see, oh, shit, this is coming from Caleb Merrill. You're like, oh, this guy's not, he's a guide, he's an educator, he's a forecaster, former ski patroller. Okay, I might put more stock into that. Or you might say, oh, that's because Caleb's up in the Alpine, but we're down deep in the forest where it's a different snowpack and we're not exposed to the wind loading that he's seeing. And then you could choose how you want to use it. But I think that kind of crowdsourcing of intel that the Abbey centers are constantly being like, hey, we need your data. Please, even if you didn't see anything, let us know at the end of your tour. Let's cut the time lag on that and get it in real time. I love that idea of us all pooling information. And even if you're a layperson, you know, the way they verify the forecast, there are obvious clues that my mom would be like, oh yeah, we just got a collapse. Or yeah, we're seeing rapid warming. Those are really easy bits of information to share with a push of a button that would take 5 seconds. I really like the idea of that. I think we could really increase the accuracy of the forecast and of how we manage risk in real time.
Well, Jeff, that's something you guys, that's something you guys wanted to have in there too, right? Whereas like just have a verify the forecast pop up in the middle of your tour, no matter what, just to kind of remind people to like, hey, to check in.
Yeah. Yeah, like right now, you got to think to verify the forecast, which, let's be honest, a lot of times, like if Caleb makes it down here, we're going to be having great conversation and psyched to show him some beautiful mountain terrain. And we might very well forget to verify the forecast even as professionals. And I certainly notice with lay people or when you're teaching an Abbey course, you know, the cognitive load of just being on a tour is so high that there's not a lot of extra bandwidth to be like, oh yeah, wait, all those checklists, I need to go through them. So that's coming on the roadmap is there'll be auto prompts to be like, oh, you've been going for 30 minutes. It's time to verify the forecast. What are you seeing out there? So that I think it's a great critique that people have of, hey, phones are really distracting in the backcountry. But there's a flip side of that. The sword has two edges of how can we use the phone to engage people with their environment and make the critical observations that normally they're not going to remember to do.
Yeah, I really like that. And I like how you touched on submitting observations of pertinent negatives too. So like if, you know, I think a really good skill for anybody to develop is get in the habit of debriefing your day. And part of debriefing your day should be submitting an observation, and it aids you in being able to synthesize what you saw. And I think you ask anybody who submits regular observations to their avalanche center, they probably have a really good handle on what's going on in the snowpack. Like if every tour, every other tour, they're submitting observations, it's just going to give you a better idea of if the forecast has been verified or if you can verify the forecast and other questions that you're looking to answer in your subsequent tours, right? So even if you're not seeing signs of instability, you know, and I think there's a resistance to people submitting observations because they don't want to give up their secret stash or this or that. And, you know, you don't have to get super specific, just an aspect elevation, general, general location within the range is super helpful. Yeah. Helps me a lot to see any observation, especially with pictures, when I'm writing a forecast. Yeah.
Do you have a wish list for the three different jobs that you do? Like, do you have your blue sky vision, your like dream tool that you'd love to have for avalanche forecasting, one for students you're teaching and one for when you're guiding, or, you know, that, that have your colleagues have?
That's a good question, Jeff. I think with my forecasting, I just reach for more information. So, and that you got to be careful what you ask for, because, you know, you get to a point where you're getting too much information and my little brain just can't process all of it. But, you know, my wish is just more snowtell sites, right? Like, where is, how much snow has landed and where is it? And again, with wind as well, with anemometers, we operate in a pretty data starved environment. And actually, I got the idea from Zach Guy to put up little game cameras. So like little Wi-Fi game cellular data game cameras with a snow stake. And so it's kind of like a low tech approach to being able to have a little remote snowtell site.
Oh yeah.
So I've been kind of geeking out on that and getting those around the range where I forecast. I think for what was your other question? For guiding tools?
Yeah. Like just for all the different hats you wear, like what would be, you know, like a cool tool or new approach, or I don't know, you know, just blue sky vision of like, if you could design something, what would you want as a forecaster? So you're saying, hey, more data. We're in a data-starved forecast zone, and the game cameras are like instant snowtell sites that are a couple $100 that we can do. What would you want for guiding, and what would you want maybe for your students that you're teaching?
Yeah, I think for guiding, you know, I honestly, it's the we already have it. It's the run list. It keeps me on the tracks, you know, like, and really utilizing that to its fullest extent. And you know, and there are some workarounds for the run list. You know, I've worked for operations that have yellow, and, you know, it's not just green or red, but yellow has a qualifier of like, this run is closed unless the cornice failed, or unless we saw, you know, a D2 avalanche, if it's already avalanched or something like that. Or guide consensus in the field, you know, after numerous relevant snow pits that have been dug on a similar aspect and elevation. But I think, you know, I really do think that the run list, and I've worked for operations that utilize run lists, and I've worked for operations that don't utilize run lists for various reasons. And I always feel better when I'm working off of a run list, especially when it's peer reviewed, you know, when I'm banging my head together with a couple other guides at the beginning of the day, and we're coming up with some consensus around that run list. And that can be tricky, you know, that can drag the guide meeting on for too long sometimes. And discussions can get kind of heated sometimes based on people's desires and opinions. And, I think my approach to that is like, when it's too contentious, we just close it, you know, and if you can get everybody on board for that, like we can go get more information, we can open it tomorrow. But trying to take that gray area away and not lean on that maybe yellowing of runs and just make it a clear distinction. I think that's my ideal tool for ski guiding.
I think that's a great takeaway for the public too, of, hey, if there's not consensus in your group, maybe like leave that for another day. And then, the operations that I've worked at that were, where we have yellow, it's because we're using explosives and we can send out a snow safety team. They can go throw ski cuts, throw bombs and test. And that's the clearly defined parameters of, hey, we're not worried about a PWL that's 60 cms down. We're worried about surface wind slab, and we're estimating somewhere between 6 to 12 inches deep. So we'll throw some hand charges and we'll do some ski cuts. And then we'll open it to the public. That's the yellow.
Yep, I love that. And like Irwin's a great example of where you guys live, where there's an operation that does that and has an explosives permit. So yeah, it's always nice to be able to throw a couple shots, you know, to either verify the forecast or flesh something out. But obviously we don't all have that in our arsenal of tools every day. I think for
it's a funny thing. For explosives, so many times we're like, oh, for sure this is going to go. And you throw a bunch of charges or you put a big AMFO 10 pounder on there and you're like, how did that not go?
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, we got two charges left that you've already made them up. So you got to burn them. You're like, well, this isn't going to go, but it'll help stabilize the slope and disrupt the layers in the future. So let's, and then D2.5, you're like, nobody saw that coming in morning meeting. That was a surprise.
Yeah, there's almost no better way to like understand or see spatial variability in action than like a bunch of no result charges thrown and then one random charge pulls the whole thing out, you know?
Yeah, like the fifth charge on the slope next to the rock. It's that, you know, super weak spot, the landmine. The other charges didn't do anything and you're like, oh, well, we just nuke the heck out of this slope. And then someone's like, oh, I got my last charge. Okay. And then the whole thing rips and you're like, whoa, that variability was, really impressive. Yeah. Sorry, I cut you off. What were you about to say?
I think Dave had something there.
Oh, I was just going to say, and that, folks, is why being the last person down a run is not a guarantee of safety.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, in the education realm, I think like the best tool that we can impart on people is to develop good habits, right? And have a repeatable process and communication, pick your partners. I know that's not really like one tool. I mean, Aspect Avi, it's right there. You know, you download Aspect Avi and start using it, and that's going to help you to develop some good habits out there that are going to inform your tour planning and set you up for a successful, safe day.
That's our goal.
That's how we see it. Yeah. And what I'm really excited for, I think we talked about, is the run list coming out, where it'll be all the classic run lists for your favorite areas. Nobody's secret stashes, just publicly stuff. And so that's your run list. If it's in the red, hey, that's high risk. And if it's in the clear, great. That gets you in there. But just like when you're guiding, just because it says it's low risk on the run list doesn't mean that you turn your brain off. You're like, oh, I'm going to use my toolbox in the app. I'm going to measure the run out angle. I'm going to use my drop-in checklist. I'm going to verify the slope angle in the field, verify the forecast, all that stuff. It just gets you in the door and like, okay, we've got 10 runs that we can work with here in this zone. All right, let's go out and find out and manage the uncertainty with the tools in the app.
Yeah, and I think for folks that are in areas that maybe, especially with the Aspect Avi app, that don't have, you know, this run list that's coming down the pike, you know, like now is the time. And I don't know when this podcast is going to come out, but like it's October 21st. And like now is the time to be doing your homework for the season and investigating options for your frequented backcountry touring areas. And get on Google Earth or, you know, use the last 9 days of FatMap that are here. I think FatMap's about to go away, but I love FatMap for like terrain visualization. Google Earth does a pretty good job too, but really like start to create a run list for areas that you go and start to really dissect what that terrain actually looks like. Look at the slope angles, look at the run out angles, and come up with, create a folder on your computer and start getting aerial imagery if you can do that, especially with snow cover. Try and get pictures of that terrain with avalanches in them. Look where the frequent runners are. And all of that is just going to lead you to be able to minimize your exposure when it's warranted. But as a procrastinator, I often will put that off, right? And so I think now is like, these are kind of rainy fall days are like the perfect time to really like dig into that and create your own terrain atlas and your run list for areas that you go. I think that's time well spent for sure. Yeah.
I'm always shocked this time of year when I'm starting to look for grassy slopes for early season skiing. And it is true. We live in the Rocky Mountains. And when you look at it now, you're like, geez, man, there is so much rock and ledge and rollovers in there. And, you know, from a scraping your skis or wrecking yourself on rocks perspective, but also from, oh, these are all going to be trigger points, stress points in the snowpack. And particularly like the anthracite range here, it's known as like the anthracite mountain resort, because so many people go there to tour because it gets great snow and it's good access. But when you look at East Bowl, where we've had a couple fatalities over the years and numerous close calls, my first human triggered avalanche was right there on a pair of tele skis with 3-pin bindings and fish scales. You can see why, because it's so ledgy and there's so many alders in there. And you're like, oh, this is just a breeding ground for facets. And it takes a ton of snow, like more than 2 meters, to really bridge all that stuff and you know, get out of that temperature gradient regime where you're just going to be breeding facets on these really steep slopes that also tend to get wind loaded.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, many areas in the West have seen their first snowfall already. And it's important to track those, where the snow melts and where it hangs out, right? Like what you're speaking of the shady high north aspects, where some of the snow is probably going to stick around for the duration. I would imagine in Colorado and start your snowpack as it often does, is as weak sugary facets near the ground. I'm always like blown away by, and it's understandable, but how people are just chomping at the bit early season, right? Like going out and wrecking themselves on low season snowpack or early season low snowpack. And, yeah. And then like they hang their skis up and their boards like in early April and they're ready to mountain bike. And it's like, wait a second, like April, May, June, it's like some of the best skiing. The coverage is there, stability is there, days are longer. So that always like kind of blows my mind. And I think we'll see some trends shift with just changing climate and different weather patterns that are coming in. You know, we're certainly already seeing that play out in the snowpack with longer stretches of high pressure and more intense, you know, time periods where persistent weak layers can develop and then big intense snowfalls that create avalanches. So it'll be interesting to see how the trends over time kind of like shift our patterns in use either earlier or later in the season. Yeah.
What are some prep things that you're going to be doing to ramp up for guiding or for forecasting?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Jeff. Like I said, kind of just like investigating different terrain options. We're super lucky out in northeastern Oregon. We have a vast amount of terrain that's kind of uncharted and has been unguided. And so we're excited about offering some new traverses, especially in the springtime, and kind of some.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah, just. And personally for me, like I'm looking at getting deeper into the range in the spring and doing some traverses. So I think just investigating terrain options, it's cool. In my career, I've bounced around a little bit and it's always fun to like get to a new zone and really dissect it, start to expand my field of vision. Whatever, 4 or 5 years I've been out in northeastern Oregon, like I have a pretty good handle on a lot of the core terrain, but I'm excited to kind of expand that view and start to explore some areas that are uncharted for me. So yeah, putting the work in to look at different terrain options for that and kind of expand the scope of where we ski guide is an exciting venture for sure.
And is that going to be some like hut to hut touring or like camping touring, or what are you looking at?
Yeah, we offer like a traverse from the southern Malawas up to the northern Malawas in the spring. We usually do two of those. And that's all camping. Yep. Mids and snow camping. Hopefully hit a nice weather window there. And there are a number of ski camps in the Malawas, yurts and huts that are out there. And you could pretty easily connect some of those up. There's kind of a big stretch in the deep in the wilderness that you know, you probably have to bivy for a night between a couple of shelters. But yeah, there's some cool opportunities there. Not many people around.
That sounds really cool. Yeah.
And if folks wanted to do a tour with you out there, do one of those traverses or a day trip, how would they get a hold of you?
Yeah, I work mostly for my friends, Victor and Kelly McNeil. They own Eagle Cap Mountain Guides. And so we operate a yurt out of the Western Wallowas there and offer day skiing and yurt-based skiing access by machines up to the yurt and then ski touring from there. The yurt's kind of like right on the edge of the wilderness boundary. So we use the machines to get in there and then ski tour for the rest of the week. And that's just eaglecapmountainguides.com. So you can check out some offerings there. Pretty cool place if you've never ventured out there, kind of off the radar, just like we like it.
Is it kind of similar to like touring in like Little Cottonwood Canyon on a powder day, something like that?
That's pretty hard to beat, Jeff. I mean,
I meant from a people use, like finding a parking spot at 6 a.m. or
sounds like pretty much not
anybody like out there at all.
Yeah, you got to reserve the parking out in Union, Oregon. It's you don't see many people out there. Like we hardly ever see anybody in our ski terrain that we guide in that is not being guided. Or if we do, then we know them, right?
Yeah.
That's cool.
And part of that is just access, like it's private parking to gain access to this point in the range. So, you know, there's been a guidebook that got put out recently that is a bit contentious. A non-local that did a lot of aerial photography it's great. It's a great resource, and I do like looking at the book, but from like a risk management standpoint, it's kind of just like, it's a bit akin to just like eye candy, right? It's not giving really good beta. It's almost giving people enough information just to get themselves in trouble, which I feel conflicted about with people putting information out like that. So it has like put the area on the radar a bit more, but it's still pretty quiet out there.
I've definitely learned to appreciate more and more the solitude aspect, like after like so many decades guiding out of Chamonix and the Alps in general, people are like, well, why did you come back here? And I'm like, well, the solitude is part of the experience, and I'm just kind of over waiting in lines at trams and stuff, and I'd much rather just go out someplace that where we're not going to see anybody. Or like you said, if we do, someone we know, I'm like, oh, hey, I'll share a little thermos hot cocoa. Yeah, let's hang out. I really enjoy that aspect of it too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, to be fair, you just admitted to me like 3 days ago that you've pretty much never skied any resort in Colorado. So you haven't even seen crowds yet, dude.
I know. We're so spoiled. I walk 100 feet to the stop sign, take the bus up to Crested Butte ski area, and it's not into traveling to go wait in lines or get stuck in traffic. So I think the only places I've skied are probably like Monarch. I did go in there because it's super chill. Maybe a day at Telluride, and that might be it.
Well, we're talking about going to Wolf Creek tomorrow.
Wolf Creek. I really like Wolf Creek. Like Wolf Creek. It's super chill. Yeah. Great local food, too, in the cafe.
They're opening this weekend, I heard.
Opening tomorrow. So we're talking about going down. Yeah, something like 26 inches out of the storm.
Nice.
Yeah, it finally looks like winter here. It's been kind of tiptoeing around, like solid fall weather for a week, and now it's like woke up with snow on the ground. So I think we're headed the right direction.
Yeah, I was seeing some snow shed off of Jeff's roof there back in the background.
I know, yeah. Yeah. Some I'm going to go out for a quick party, ski up on the pass that after we get off of here, grab some lunch, and then take the dog up so he doesn't totally hate me for not playing in the snow today.
Well, on that note, we could probably wrap this up. Caleb, thank you so much for doing this. It's cool talking to you, man. You're an insightful dude for sure. And I like hearing kind of the way you think about it from someone who's had so many high level conversations in the industry. Really cool.
Yeah. And Caleb, one last question. Are there any projects that you'd like to share with the audience and bring their attention to?
Yeah, I guess a couple that are kind of front of mind for me are kind of like, one, just supporting your Avalanche Center, right? Like, there's been a bit of a scare recently with the 2025 temp seasonal hiring freeze. I don't know if you guys know about that, but
from the government,
from the United States Forest Service. Yeah. So, and I'm not sure exactly where it's at right now, but they're saying that they were going to not hire any temporary seasonals other than fire essential staff for 2025, which could significantly affect avalanche centers, right? Wow. Like, there's 14 Forest Service avalanche centers. There's 9 additional nonprofit centers or state run centers.
Yep.
And, you know, I think it just highlights the need for community support of these avalanche centers and supporting your friends group, friends of the avalanche centers, that can kind of step in to fill that void if the federal government kind of drops the ball on being able to hire some of these essential employees, what we see as essential employees for sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, just a plug for supporting your local avalanche center. I think the Avalanche Alliance is doing some great work. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with that organization. It's a motorized organization, started by some folks at Climb, and ARI has a big part in that too. You know, like this last year they raised, something like $80,000. I think $71,000 in grants were awarded to different avalanche centers, and many of those are nonprofit avalanche centers that don't get funding from the Forest Service. So they raise money for avalanche centers to expand education, bring about more weather stations, and just general outreach to the motorized community. So I think some folks in the ski world like are a little bit unaware of all the support that comes from the motorized community that's helping their avalanche centers to function at a higher level. And then the last one would be like the Avalanche Resilience Project, and the American Avalanche Association in general is such a connector of our community and kind of the web that keeps many of us together and connected. And so all of the projects that are ongoing by the A3, whether it's looking at pro and rec education, trying to refine that and make it better. And one of the projects that I specifically like is the Avalanche Resilience Project, which is like mental health initiatives for workers in the industry, funding for team trainings. And, you know, if you're struggling with mental health and work in the industry, like there's money there for you to go talk to somebody. Right. So I think that's a huge step in the right direction as an industry as a whole, because this job can take its toll on you for sure.
Yeah.
No matter what aspect you're working at it from. So those are a few that I'm kind of like jazzed up on that I think people should know about. There's a lot of others out there as well.
We'll link those for sure.
Yeah.
Cool.
And I think maybe a lot of lay people who are outside the industry aren't familiar with the work of the AAA, but they're like the umbrella organization governing body for everything avalanche, and connect all the different spokes of the wheel and provide the overarching guidelines for the recreational class you're going to take. And so all those are AAA approved, or hopefully. they're the ones that set standards and say, hey, you need to cover these in your recreational program, avalanche course. How you do that can be flexible, but you need to hit these points.
Yeah, it's definitely advised to like take your avalanche education from an A3 recognized provider, right? Like they're hitting the standards.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, this has been super fun, you guys. It's great to be on the other side of the mic, and had a blast.
Hell yeah. Well, yeah, thanks for coming on. Obviously, one last plug, you know, the Avalanche Hour podcast, if anyone hasn't heard of it, like me, go check it out. It's a wealth of information, and I don't know.
Yeah.
You got any last words?
I think one of the ways that that Caleb, you do a good job of sharing information is through stories that resonate. And, you know, I spend a lot of time looking at data, but I don't remember that. But what I remember is stories that have an emotional resonance. And I think that's the thread that connects all the podcasts and guests that you have. There are these stories that stick with you and add to your avalanche processing power, and that when you're out there in the field. So thanks for that.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad if it's working. Keep doing it.
Yeah, and if you ever find yourself in Colorado, let's go skiing.
Yeah, let's do
That'd
it.
That'd be sick.
Look forward right. to it. I gotta make it back to us and you soon. Yeah.
Yeah, we'd love that.
All right, guys. We'll chat later.
Take it easy.
Thanks.
Have a good one. Appreciate it.
See ya.